Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. Today is Thursday, April 25th, 2019. I am John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary. With me, as always, senior editor Abe Greenwald. Hi, Abe.
Hi, John.
Associate editor Noah Rothman making a face about his coffee. I don't know why.
What was happened, repulsive. Noah? This is not good coffee.
Bad coffee. Yeah, bad coffee. And in Washington, senior writer Christine Rosen. Hi, Christine.
Hi, John.
Commentaries, of course, the 70-odd-year-old monthly of intellectual analysis, political probity, and cultural criticism. From a conservative perspective, we invite you to join us at commentarymagazine.com. We give you a few free reads. We ask you to subscribe, $19.95 for a digital subscription and $29.95 for an all-access subscription, including our beautiful monthly magazine in your mailbox 11 times a year. We are still hawking our new May issue, with a lead article by Noah Rothman on the pent-up Democratic policy proposals of following 8 years of inactivity that followed the 2018 congressional triumph by the Democrats. Abe Greenwald on our neurotic politics. Christine Rosen on the cultural fallout of the Varsity Blues investigation. John Lerner on Nikki Haley's tenure at the UN and the radical refocusing of American attention on the Israel-Palestine problem in the direction of Israel's interests rather than Barack Obama's hatred of Bibi Netanyahu, and many other things. So please go to our website, read these pieces, and subscribe, because you can only read a few before you need to subscribe. We're going to do something a little different today. Rather than focus on the entry into the presidential race of Joe Biden, about which we have already spoken incessantly and will probably continue to speak incessantly over the course of the year, we were all, although I think we can reflect some of what happened with Biden and his decision to enter the race from what we're going to talk about, which is this remarkable survey by the Pew Research Center on the Twitter and the use of Twitter, where Pew surveyed almost 3,000 adult Twitter users willing to share their Twitter handles and discovered that basically what we have all thought was the case is the case, which is that the world of Twitter is wildly unrepresentative of America as a whole, that 22% of American adults who use Twitter are young. That's the number of Americans who use Twitter. They are younger, more likely to identify as Democrats, more highly educated, have higher incomes than U.S. adults overall, more likely to say that immigrants strengthen rather than weaken the country, and to see evidence of racial and gender-based inequalities in society. They are not overwhelmingly, but predominantly. Okay, the most active users are predominantly female, more left-wing than the overall universe of Twitter users, and more activist. So what you get here is a world in which the entire political class and the entire commentariat has subsumed itself and sort of lives at least part of the time literally, I mean, not lives, but sort of works or sort of cultivates the vineyard of Twitter on a daily basis, and is having conversations between themselves and all of that, and that what they are experiencing is a world that does not reflect the predominant American society or the true nature of American political opinion, and they are therefore, one can assume, unconsciously, constantly pushed in the direction of the most activist tweeters, and imagine falsely that their concerns and obsessions more precisely reflect the beliefs and views of all Americans than they do. Christine, as our resident Luddite and a person hostile to social media, most hostile to social media, perhaps. Do you want to dilate a little on all of this?
Sure. I think this report is fascinating for a number of reasons. I mean, we've talked before on the podcast about how Twitter can be an extremely efficient machine for character assassination, for example. And if the most fascinating, there are two takeaways from the report that I found interesting. The first is that, you know, as you mentioned, 80% of the tweets come from 10% of the users, right? The highest level users. It's just 10% of those users are producing the vast majority of tweets. And of those high intensity users, 65% of the most active users are women, right? So if you're worried about, you know, we've had these various Twitter scandals with harassment and Gamergate, and these are all driven by women complaining about how they're treated on Twitter. But they're the majority on Twitter. They're technically setting the tone, right? So if character assassination and harassment are a problem on Twitter, I think there needs to be less victim mongering by the women who dominate on this platform, and more efforts to look a little bit more critically at their own behavior. The second thing I would note is that there was an interesting statistic buried in there that Twitter, the active Twitter users were somewhat less likely to report being very attached to their local communities. It was a small difference, 12% versus 70%, you know, more broadly among American adults. But that to me also was striking, because I think a lot of these very active users on Twitter who are, as you said, not like the rest of America, they find a community on Twitter. And there's a lot of praise for that in among people who are active on social media platforms. But given what we know about Twitter's power and reach, and again, the character assassination issue, maybe that's not the best form of community. And maybe these active users actually should be making more efforts to become attached to more local communities, ones that might give them a little more perspective.
Worse, it's like an anti-community.
Yes, it's
a community that resents community sentiment and the kind of attachment.
Well, it's a community like Salem. I mean, I don't know, you know, or it's a community like a block committee in Cuba.
Right. But there's no emotional support available to you. Right. And
well,
nothing,
like a block community in Cuba, where basically, you know, say the wrong thing,
right,
raise the wrong eyebrow, make a face in the wrong direction, and you are set upon. And there is an act of group enforcement through shaming and what do we call it? Cancel culture now? What's the call out culture?
Call out culture.
Right.
It's a struggle session.
Yes. Right. So so there is a community, but the community is enforced almost entirely negatively, or the positive
and arbitrarily.
Or the positive aspect of community is the positive aspect of social media, which is so unnerving, which is just the desperate desire to be liked by people who don't know who you are. I mean, that, you know, or literally know nothing about you. So there's all question of whether or not you get enough retweets, you get enough likes, whether your ratio is more favorably in the direction of your likes than of the comments.
By the way, you know, this is fascinating because throughout history, there were the reward structure was such that you were rewarded for being able to ingratiate yourself into a real community. This is an opportunity for those who haven't done that to reap rewards. These are people who are not actually close to real communities, and now they're out here, sort of, you know, getting their likes and their followers and whatnot.
Well, they're getting the rewards. Yeah, the rewards, but without the responsibilities that real community demands, right? The showing up for others when you're not getting retweeted or liked for it. I mean, that's the part that I think you're absolutely right. They're getting that dopamine hit and that emotional reward, but they're not actually having to be responsible either for their behavior in many cases or towards others.
So this dovetails with the Times report that we talked about briefly, and Christine, you've written about it. And it talks about social media, not Twitter per se, although I think Twitter is really the big dominant force in Democratic politics, particularly when it comes to politics, especially. And this talks about Democrats on Twitter and how they differ from Democrats in real life. And so just briefly, some top lines from that study. 29% of Democrats on social media identify as moderates or conservatives. 53% of Democrats in the real world do so. 48% of Democrats on social media say political correctness is a problem in the United States. 70% of actual Democrats agree with that sentiment. And 27% of Democrats on social media say they don't follow the news all that much, whereas 59% of Democrats in the universe of Democratic voters say as much.
Okay, so this is, I think, the ultimate question about Twitter as we go into the 2019-2020 political season. And this is a point that I make in my article in the May issue of Commentary, using the analogy, using the analogy that I've made before on this podcast, to Plato's allegory of the cave. So if you remember the Plato's allegory of the cave, he postulates that there are people who are forced in life to sit in a fixed position, unable to swivel their heads. And all they can see, and the light from the sun is sort of ahead of them. So in the end, all they can see are shadows, and they have no perspective on which to judge whether the shadows they believe the shadows to be real, and so they don't know that depending on the position of the sun, a shadow can be 10 times larger than the object that it is, you know, casting off of, or not. So they have no sense of the real world. And then when you introduce them to the real, you release them from this position of bondage, and you take them out and say, look, this is what the world is really like. They don't like to know that, because their entire cosmology and understanding of the universe is based on this lived experience of how they've seen the shadows. And they want to believe in the shadows. They don't want to believe in the reality, because the change is too upsetting. So using this analogy, which is about, you know, wisdom and lived experience as opposed to fixed ideas in one's head, does the political world... is the political world and the commentariat living in Plato's cave on Twitter? That what they are seeing are reflected shadows that overestimate the size of the political activist class, the opinions of the political activist class, and that every time one emerges, is released from this somehow by the New York Times story, this Pew survey, or if you live in politics, by the actual lived reality of what people are telling you around the country, like in 2018 when people were saying, talk about healthcare, don't talk about impeachment, talk about healthcare. That's the best thing for Democrats to talk about if you want to win in November.
They're also
they want to go back in the cave. They want to live in the world of Twitter. And is this harmful, or, and Abe, this is where you need to get into this, are they the vanguard? Are they right to believe in the shadow world? Because the shadow world becomes, over time, the real world. And some of this divergence that Christine was saying, we were talking about the numbers, it's not that the Twitter world is in conflict with the realities of American politics. It just, it's further to the left of it. But then the question is that the direction that the country is going in?
Right. So there's a section of the Pew poll where the heading is, Twitter users have somewhat different attitudes than the general population. So they note, for example, a larger share of Twitter users who, as noted, are more likely to identify as Democrats, say that blacks are treated less fairly than whites. That's 64% of Twitter users versus 54% of Americans. They are also more likely to say that the U.S. general public, more likely to say than is the U.S. General public that immigrants strengthen the U.S. That's 66% of Twitter users as opposed to 57% of the general public, and that barriers exist in society that make it harder for women to get ahead. That's 62% of Twitter users and 56% of the general public. These aren't huge gaps. It's like the Twitter users are the sort of the spearhead of the left in some sense. What's interesting to me about this is, isn't this also kind of just a version of what happened in 2016? What about the bubble that the Democrats had sort of determined that they were living in, that didn't speak to most Americans all those years ago. I mean, isn't this if it was a bubble then, isn't this a bubble now? If it's a bubble, I mean, if it's the same problem, right? Whether it's Twitter or whether it's the general media, the actual media, we're still talking about the same gap. But I don't know that it's a gap. Is I think my ultimate point here.
Well, it's a gap, but what you're suggesting is that the Twitter users represent an American vanguard, that they are
right.
They are reflecting a journey. Now, here's the other shadow question, which always goes to polling, which is it that the Twitter activist class believes in these ideas, but that the public, when polled about them, knows what they're supposed to say? You know, that they're supposed to say it's harder for women to get ahead or whatever, but because they are educated enough in cultural realities by pop culture and other things to know what the thing is that you're supposed to think, but they don't really think it, or it doesn't mean anything to them, or it's not what they vote on, or it's not what they care about.
Well, in truth, I mean, actually, and if you look at the actual questions that I just read off, they are kind of vague and not terribly controversial sentiments. I mean, the idea that life is more unfair for blacks than whites in America is not, that's not saying something crazy. The idea that there are barriers for certain segments of the population, or that immigration is good as opposed to bad, these aren't wild stances.
Right.
They're just generally liberal sort of attitudes.
It would then reflect a failure of the Trump revolution if what I'm saying is right, and that people are just sort of echoing, you know, what they believe to be appropriate sentiment on matters that are of little moment to them, that it's a failure of the Trump revolution to make any cultural gains, which was partially this, you know, that's how you got Trump, right? Is that they, you know, there's this enforced orthodoxy that silences people and makes it impossible for them to talk about what's real. And Trump is, you know, letting the genie out of the bottle, letting people say what they think and believe what they believe and all of that. Apparently, if that was an aspect of the Trump revolution, which I'm very doubtful of, actually, in certain ways, except within the Republican Party, in its own negotiations with itself, then he's gotten nowhere.
But that's reflected a little bit in the Pew survey, because I don't have the actual statistic in front of me, but very few, a very small percentage of the people who are active on Twitter or even on Twitter in general will identify themselves as very conservative. So it's not a space where conservatives are all that active as a rule. I mean, Donald Trump is actually an outlier in that he's the leader of the Republican Party right now and very active on Twitter, and if news reports are correct, was complaining to Jack Dorsey this week about how, you know, his followers,
right, the CEO of Twitter, right,
that he's... So, but I do think one of the things that's, I think you could both be right in a sense, right? If you look at, and we've talked about this before, about attitudes towards a lot of these identity politics issues among younger voters, that is reflected in Twitter, right? I mean, people on Twitter are on average younger. The users are younger. Younger voters are moving more towards the left on a lot of these identity politics issues. And I think that was the other fascinating takeaway, and why I should add everybody needs to read Noah's book, Unjust. It's race, gender, and immigration. Race and gender in particular fuel so many of the Twitter wars that go on a daily basis. And I think the concern is that so many of these active users are media, right? These are the writers, the editors, the producers, and they are fueling the cultural conversation above and beyond whether you're on Twitter or not. Many of the things that end up on Fox and Friends and CNN, some of those start on Twitter as controversies. So I think we shouldn't, even if you're not on Twitter, the downstream effect of Twitter is quite large in our political culture these days.
Yeah, by the way, I think it's worth dwelling on the fact that this report says nothing really about right-wing Twitter, and especially sort of scary bigoted, racist right-wing Twitter, yes. which is shocking, because that was something that all of us, we've written about it here, and we were sort of trying to find a way to quantify how many, you know, racist alt-righters were out there.
Right.
And how, and whether or not they were representative of the right at large, and what sort of threat to our society that they represent, and we sort of don't know anything about that from this.
Right. Well, one other aspect of this is some of this is associative just by demographically, right? So Christine says there are very few very conservative Twitter users, but we know is the most active Twitter users are young. And the most conservative voters in the United States are old, right? It's right. Sort of whites over 50 were the heart and soul of the Trump electorate, and less educated whites. And we know that Twitter is more educated than the public as a whole, and all of that. So it makes logical sense that right wing Twitter is not reflected, because right-wing Twitter is a very, very much smaller component of this ecosystem.
Pew does a Facebook study, then we're going to get the right-wing crazies.
Yes.
Well, I mean, also, that's part of the interesting thing about Twitter, social media in general, because we talk about Twitter and Facebook and Snapchat and Instagram as though they're all sort of like part of the same phenomenon, and they're really not. For one thing, Facebook is 10 times the size of Twitter, and yet Twitter has more cultural, intellectual, and media purchase than Facebook does, although not in business terms, because, you know, all of media sold its soul to Facebook 3 years ago, and then got totally screwed when Facebook changed the system that it had sort of ginned up to get them all to hand them their subscriptions and readers. Facebook is vastly larger, but it's not as intense. And the secret of Twitter, which I think goes to the statistic that 80%, that 10% of the tweeters do 80% of the tweets, intensity is the secret and hallmark of Twitter.
Yeah, this also makes sense for those of us who at least read a lot of Twitter, if don't tweet a lot actively. And that's that. So much of the communication on Twitter ends up being so inside. There are all these sort of personal and professional grudges that play out.
Yeah.
Sometimes it can be hard to even follow what the initial point of an argument was.
Yeah. And the opposite, a lot of back scratching.
Right. That's right.
Implicit job, you know, implicit requests for job interviews. You know, sort of buttering people up.
I have a great example of this, by the way. So I actually want to pull up this quote because it's indicative of this phenomenon. The reporting culture in particular, reporters, there's maybe 600 of them that spend their life on Twitter in this circular conversation, which is very self-reinforcing. And one of the things that we've seen a lot is how Elizabeth Warren is fantastic on the stump. You know, she's maybe not getting a lot of traction in polls, but you just haven't seen her speak, man, because she has command of that audience and she knows the issues. And we already talked last week about how her command of the issues consists of telling people whatever they want to hear, embracing impeachment, her obviously unconstitutional wealth tax proposal, and her extremely innovative notion of just bailing out taxpayers who are over, or with taxpayer funds, debtors who are over their head. Really innovative stuff. So she's on the stump yesterday at She the People 2020 conference. And one of these really fantastic lines that just killed is the following. When your ears are stuffed with money, you can't hear well. Let that simmer for a second. This is how fantastic she is at this campaigning game. This self-reinforcing, no, you can't dissent from that notion or else you're contradicting the hive mind here. But this is self-evidently awful. She's terrible. That's horrible. I wouldn't say that and get a laugh from my four-year-old.
Right. So I think in particular what's interesting in the solipsistic world of media are the ways in which people who report on the media for the media are objects of intense fascination, retweeting, argumentation, and all of that on Twitter, because it's like Twitter is like a daily convention for the mainstream media. Have you ever been at a convention? It's like, you know, it's just a way of having conversations. Look, I've worked at 7 or 8 news organizations and magazines in my life, so that, which is a lot. And so I know hundreds of people in the press. And when I went on Twitter, I followed a lot of people that I know. And it's like running into them at the bus stop or on the subway or something like that to see a tweet of theirs. And then you kind of like send a joking tweet back. Well, then you have, that's me. I'm 58 years old. I've been in this business for, you know, almost 40 years. And so I know a lot of people. And then you have the people who want to be in this world. And so one of the, they can try to forge and create, at least in their own heads, a kind of intimacy with people that they don't know. In the most extreme fashion, that's what leads people to follow celebrities on Twitter who have, you know, 20 million followers and never see a single tweet that anybody tweets at them, because it's all a professional PR operation. But you have this really a hunger to be part of that community. And therefore, Jake Tapper, who I would say, of CNN, who I would say was the person who best used Twitter in its early years to establish a reputation among people who, this is before he had a show of his own and all of that, he was very active, he's witty, he's funny, he's actually kind of, he's a nice guy, smart. And so he developed a kind of reputation for his personality on Twitter that I'm sure was extremely helpful to his career at CNN. You know, he sort of used it. He used his natural charm and kind of less ideological anger, what, the fact that he's not that ideological, to kind of build an audience for himself that CNN surely said, boy, that, you know, Jake really is somebody who connects with people.
So briefly, to Plato's cave analogy again. So we're beginning to see this is being tested now in the presidential race, where you have the really the wokest candidates, the most progressive candidates, and the dissenters who are aiming towards the general election, and the dissenters who are essentially revolting from the notion that you have to appeal to this Twitter audience are beginning to get some pushback, sotto voce pushback. There was a piece in the Associated Press yesterday talking about the quote woke litmus test that is imposed on candidates who are, especially white male candidates, who are expected to withdraw from certain fora and to self-abase. And they singled Biden out for criticism and Bernie Sanders to a lesser extent for waging a campaign that is, quote, aimed at winning back working class white voters who swung to Trump in 2016. The subtext there is those voters are not worth getting. And to appeal to them in the sense that Bernie Sanders is and Joe Biden are very different ways in policy terms, but also expressly and explicitly appealing to them, is morally compromising. There was a companion piece in National Public Radio talked about electability, also singling Joe Biden out for criticism, because the notion that he is electable in 2020 is itself a little suspect, because by virtue of asking yourself that question, you are, to quote an expert, quote, erecting a post hoc rationalization for the fact that you are harboring sexist biases, or homophobic biases in the case of Pete Buttigieg, or anti-minority biases, because you're not supporting the candidates in the race who are women, minorities, or gay.
Right. Now, here's what's interesting about that. We on the right know this intimately, because you'll remember Jim DeMint, senator from South Carolina, who then became head of the Heritage Foundation, saying, seriously, he would rather have 30 good conservatives in the Senate than 60 Republicans of all ideological makeups, right? That's deranged. That politically, that was deranged. 30 Republicans in the Senate can't stop, can't filibuster, they can't prevent cloture. There is nothing that they can do. And yet the idea was that the ideological purity of the right needed to be reflected in its electoral bodies. That would be preferable to the compromises that would need to be made if there was greater ideological spread in the party. And that fight went on during the Tea Party years forever. It was like, no, you don't pick Todd Akin in Missouri. He's crazy. And it's like, whoa, you say he's crazy? Well, he's, you know, he's good on the issues, you know, like that. And then you lose the seat. Democrats are tempted, all ideologues are tempted by the idea that what they most need to do is purify their own side before they can go out and, you know, run. Because if they run things without revolutionizing themselves and radicalizing themselves, then they will be compromised and they will do terrible, horrible things. So having said that, the fights within the Republican Party from 2010 to 2015 obviously softened the ground for Donald Trump. Although one thing you could say about Donald Trump is he wasn't ideologically pure on, you know, on
anything
right-wing issues. Although as president, you know, let's face it. So the Tea Party doesn't care much about trade. Trade is an elite issue, right? But the Tea Party, you know, certainly cared about abortion and cared about, you know, various other things. And Trump has been very good on the, you know, right.
Here's the distinction there, though. So okay. Donald Trump inherited a Republican Party that was conservative. There was no intellectual infrastructure for Trumpism, whatever that was.
Right.
With the exception of maybe Stephen Miller and Lighthizer on trade and immigration, respectively. Every other issue is dominated by pretty much boilerplate conservatives, and you had an essentially boilerplate conservative administration. That's not the case for Democrats. There is an intellectual infrastructure for progressivism, and a Democratic administration, even if it was Joe Biden's administration, would be populated by a lot of progressive ideologues, far left ideologues.
That's exactly right. Although you could say the same. So it is the same ultimately. You're saying when Trump came in, as we've been saying since 2017, with the exception of his own rhetoric and personal behavior and trade, primarily, and some of the ideas on foreign policy, he has run a relatively conventional Republican administration.
Yeah. So my contention is that Joe Biden would run a very progressive administration by virtue of the fact that he would have to staff it with progressives.
But in other words, he would run a very conventional Democratic administration, okay. Given the fact that was the Obama. Right, in other what we have here is this idea that, I mean, it's not as though Obama has turned into George W. Bush for the party. I mean, they're not looking at Obama and saying, boy, you know, he screwed us. They should, by the way.
Some of them are. Omar did.
Yep. No, the Democratic Socialists are explicitly revisionist.
Right. But I'm saying mostly it does not appear as though, I mean, I don't think that you will have a major Democratic candidate who will run on the grounds that Barack Obama drove the Democratic Party into the ground, though he did. He far more did than Bush drove the Democratic Party into the ground. I mean, we've gone over this 10,000 times, right? That by the time Obama left office, they'd lost the House, they'd lost the Senate, they'd lost 30, you know, they'd lost 1,000 legislative seats and all of that. But I don't think he's not, I believe he's viewed fondly, and even in policy terms should be viewed fondly. I mean, you know, okay, so he didn't do single-payer health care, but, you know, his heart was in the right place. He did, I don't know. The whole thing is a little silly, and before we go on, I just want to stop and talk to you about stress, because stress is a worldwide epidemic. You know, we're working longer hours, we're inundated with the constant news cycle, and we're more connected than ever before. Stress is a part of life, but it can very easily affect our overall well-being. That's why we're partnering with Calm, the number one app, to help you reduce your anxiety and stress and help you sleep better. More than 40 million people, including our own A. Greenwald, around the world have downloaded it. If you head to calm.com/commentary, you'll get 25% off a Calm premium subscription, which includes guided meditations on issues like anxiety, stress, and focus, including a brand new meditation each day. There are also sleep stories, bedtime stories for adults designed to help you relax. Head to the magical lavender fields of southern France with Stephen Fry, or explore the moonlit jungles of Africa with Leona Lewis. They even have soothing music and more. As I say, I'm gonna say this because Abe has said it before, but, you know, Abe's got insomnia issues, and he has said many times he goes on Calm. He, you know, he it Sousa clarifies comms night, goes to, I can see it. I can see the effect in the morning on Abe when he's dragging or when he's used calm. So right now, commentary listeners get 25% off a calm premium subscription at calm.com/commentary. That's calm.com/commentary. Get unlimited access to all of calm's content today at calm.com/commentary. Get calm and stop stressing. So Joe Biden is going to announce today, right? And so here's the phenomenon of Joe Biden. Phenomenon of Joe Biden is he goes into the race. He enters the race in a very strong position, in the strongest position of anybody entering the race. Not that entering a race in a strong position does any good to you necessarily, because obviously Hillary Clinton entered the race in a strong position in 2007 and lost to Obama in 2008. Having said that, you'd rather have 20 to 30% nationally in the polls and in Iowa and in New Hampshire than not have them, right? I mean, by definition, like, you prefer not to be at 2%. And so in the Twitter ecosystem, however, the bias of youth and the bias toward novelty and the bias toward women and the bias toward minorities has, I believe, as I watch this, created a weird, there's a kind of hostility toward Biden among people, not like us. We're hostile to Biden for various other reasons, but a hostility to Biden that seems almost like motiveless malignity. Like, there's nothing that he does, except maybe for being handsy, or has represented in his voting record in the Senate, with the exception of a couple of, one in the 70s and one in the 90s, right, around criminal justice issues and busing. But that's it, and various other things. There's very little in his record that would lead progressives to say he betrays everything we stand for. But they just don't seem to like him that much because he's not fresh, and he doesn't have an added oomph of identity, of the right kind of identity politics.
I keep thinking that when I see him and when I watch the video this morning, it's like if Johnny Carson were to suddenly enter the late night game now, you know, it's like the second Carson retired, I thought of course he retired. We are in a different age. Biden's is this, you know, sort of like leap back in time, chronologically not so long ago, but seemingly ideologically entirely different. And if I don't know who's seen the his video this morning, but one of the things that struck me was that he has to now sort of preempt every potential dig that the progressives can get at him. So he was his message is about restoring the country to the noble pursuit of its ideals after this scary aberration of Donald Trump, and he was, in talking about the founders, he had to at some point sort of add this caveat. He had to knock Jefferson for not living up to our great ideals at all times. Something that it's an aside, a sort of footnote that I think you never would have seen up until this year.
The through line of Joe Biden's candidacy so far, he's been running for president for months, has been apologizing on issues of race. All across the board. The Anita Hill hearings, he's been apologizing for. The 1994 crime bill is about the era of mass incarceration targeting disproportionately African-American men. His effort to enlist Stacey Abrams as the VP is about race. And his launch video is about race. It centers on, obviously, as you said, Thomas Jefferson's slaveholding and Charlottesville. He's aware that his bona fides on the progressive left is threatened almost explicitly by race. And the busing issue, by the way, in the crime bill, like, busing was a disaster. It was an absolute failure. It failed on its own merits, alienated its own allies.
And the crime bill was a historic game changer in the United States, part of a series of changes, most of them, by the way, here in New York. I mean, you know, an enormous amount of the change in the American, not attitude toward crime, but also sheer numbers of crimes came literally from one city, from New York. But the crime bill was part of a, you know, the 75% drop in crime over the last 25 years, which, of course, amnesia now requires us to forget. And right, again, pretend, on Twitter.
War on context. But that this is the point, right. There is that this is the cave winning. That this is a conversation within and exclusively for the cave.
Right. Well, let me point out, if I can, where is this? The tweet of the millennium, I believe, which was issued earlier this week by Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's chief of staff, Saikat Chakrabarty, in relation to the question asked on the CNN town hall of Bernie Sanders about whether or not he believed in giving felons the vote, right? Because there's an issue, right? In Florida, like ex-cons have now been given the right to vote.
Ex-cons.
Ex-cons, after they've done their
so
time.
So someone asked, should
And by the way,
felon felons.
Means you're...
Con,
you're
a current con.
No, you can be a felon even after you've been released, unless it's expunged from your
parole,
record.
Right.
You're a felon.
Right, but anyway, so...
Currently
so,
incarcerated. Right.
So the general idea, right, is that ex-cons, having served their debt to society, should get to vote after they're released from prison and they're through with their parole, which is an arguable question. We can talk about whether or not, you know, the debt to society is ever paid and all that. But okay.
Broad bipartisan agreement on that. This is a Republican legislator and a Republican governor.
There are plenty of people I know who don't agree with this. But nonetheless, we can say that this is the ex-con. But then Bernie Sanders is asked at the town hall about letting current felons vote. And he says, we need to look at it. And then somebody says this thing about, what about the Tsarnaevs, the Boston bombers? And he said, we need to look at it. So Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Saikat Chakrabarty said the following on Twitter, which is why Twitter is valuable. Okay, then there's the question of what Twitter's value is, and we can get that in a minute. What's the reason not to let incarcerated people vote? Shouldn't the people most affected by unjust laws have some say in electing people to change them? So let's follow this logic. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's chief of staff is saying that incarceration is itself unjust, and that laws that lead to people being incarcerated can and should be challenged by the people who are incarcerated, since the laws are unjust. You know, laws against burglary and attempted murder and, that sort of thing. So... there's a moment in a bad Woody Allen movie called Everyone Says I Love You, in which Goldie Hawn plays a very liberal New Yorker, and she talks about how her issue is criminal justice reform, and it's one of the and she wants air-conditioned cells, and there shouldn't be locks on the doors of prison cells, and you know, they should all be allowed to paint and do ballet and stuff like that. So that was Woody Allen trying to come up with how to make fun of, you know, rich liberal New Yorkers. And here's Saikat Chakrabarty like saying all laws that incarcerate people are unjust and they should be voted on.
I think the following tweet in that thread was about how the Constitution conveys rights to everyone, including the Second Amendment.
Right. So he's now wants to arm felons. Yeah, we should arm people
currently
in prison.
Right.
No, but this is
now, not to get to the point, but the fundamental point here is we deny felons the right to vote because we deny them all their rights. They have been imprisoned. They don't have the right to free speech. They don't have the right to free assembly. They don't have the right to nothing because they have violated and attempted to traduce all of the norms and laws of our society. Right? Okay.
But
Christine,
this,
I'm sorry.
This is a perfect example of how Twitter has changed the political culture and the political conversation, though. So this was, to me, it reminded me of the Dukakis rape question. Remember, he was asked, what would you do if your wife was raped? And he completely bungled it, right? He tried to look at, but he basically gave a version of this answer. But the difference today is that, and this is especially true of the progressive left, which is very active on Twitter, is that they constantly mistake impatience and ignorance for energy, right? It's like, well, we're going to move fast and break things in the Facebook parlance. But they, you know, this speaks to what's going on with Biden too, right? So if you look at the actual Democratic voter, and especially some of the studies that we were talking about earlier, all Biden has to do to win the primary is just not bring the crazy, right? Just be himself, be a Democrat. But what the progressive left, fueled with the attention it gets on Twitter, is going to insist upon is the opposite, right? Like, push him as far to the extreme, especially on these identity politics issues, as they can. And as Noah said, they've been doing that already, even before his official announcement. So I think that this idea that this is the way I think that Twitter is detrimental to our political discussions, because it kind of forces the hand of people who actually have more experience and interest in compromise and political culture, and says, no, we are making a list of demands. It's like they literally hold these candidates hostage every time they put out a tweet.
And they don't care about felons voting.
Of course.
What is the constituency for currently incarcerated people voting? The people advocating for it don't even care about it. It's like a way to establish your uniqueness.
Yeah. But it's the opposite. In other words, if you want the Democratic, I'm now not talking about whether or not we're talking about political correctness or anything like that. If you want the Democratic Party to win in 2020, you do not want the Democratic Party's vanguard to be advocating for the notion that laws that incarcerate people are unjust. That is just handing Donald Trump, you know, a gigantic mallet with which to whack you over the head with precisely those 100,000 voters in the, you know, in the three Midwestern and, you know, formerly industrialized states, or, you know, post-industrial states, whatever you want to call them, to go back to the polls and vote for him again, which is, again, this is the interesting thing about Biden. Biden has two appeals, right? So Biden's appeal is he is famous and he was vice president and he's an old hand, and in demeanor and carriage and all of that, is somebody who can go up against Trump toe-to-toe because he's like Trump, only he was poorer, so he can hit Trump for being rich, right? That's number one. And number two is that for all these reasons, he has a particular demographic. He can appeal to the demographic. They don't need very many of them. They only need 100,000 of them in three states. They need them to go and vote for the Democrats instead of voting for Trump, right? 22,000 people in Michigan. How many people in Pennsylvania? How many people in Wisconsin, right? So that's his appeal. And that's the electability appeal. And it has nothing to do with... Then there's all the problems that Biden had, right? He's an idiot. He's a loudmouth. He can't stop talking. He makes gaffes constantly. You know, people flee when they see him because he's so tiresome. And, you know, whether he can suppress all that for the necessary 17 or 18 months in order to win the election, it's an interesting test of, you know, what it is to be a 76, 77-year-old man and be able to restrain your worst impulses. So he's got a lot of negatives, but he has this positive, and he has one more positive, which is the message that he is peddling is not vote for me because I will bring single payer. Vote for me because I will this. Vote for me because this is a fight for the future soul of our nation. Do we want to be the nation that Donald Trump wants us to be, or do we want to forge a different, more humane, more, you know, compassionate path, right?
It's not transformative.
It's both restorative and it is transformative in the sense that it transforms, it puts Trump in the rearview mirror. So
Biden's message is make America great again.
Yeah, exactly. Right, exactly. So, and the one thing I will say, looking at all these other candidacies as we now have for 3 months, including Mayor Pete's surprising candidacy in which he's grown his support 10 times over from what it was when he started, is they don't have a message. What they have is, you know, I'm willing to pander to, you know, identity politics is the future of America. That is basically, if there's a message, it's that, not that it's put that way. Somebody is going to have to find a message to vie with Biden's message.
You know what? That's so interesting because I think because of the identitarian left being what it is, embracing a message is a risky proposal now.
Exactly.
It's like you have to lock yourself into something that can be attacked from 9 billion angles of social justice and historical injustice.
It's very early in the primary process, but the dirty secret of the Democratic Party primary so far is that the two candidates who have all but rejected identity politics make up about 40% of the vote.
Right. Exactly. And why is that? It's very simple, because presidential campaigns are about big things, not little things. They're right. Not about what you're going to give to this group and what you're going to give to that. Is what
and municipal most Americans, that I is don't what think
municipal
about
politics
race.
Is about.
Right.
Municipal politics is, I'll fix your pothole. I'll make sure that I'll make sure that that housing project doesn't go into your neighborhood. I'm gonna subsidize the subways. I'm gonna deal with the garbage. That's what hand-to-hand, down at the level, politics are. And what was Trump? Trump was, I don't even have any issues except immigration. I got nothing. I'm making America great again. This country sucks. Obama made it suck. Bush made it suck. We're going to make it suck less. It's going to be great. We're going to win so much, you're going to be tired of winning. There was nothing but big message, right? So, and Twitter, I think, is destructive of that impulse.
So it's the
right?
inverse, right? So Donald Trump was the candidate who embraced identity politics in the Republican race. Everybody else didn't, and he got about 30% of the vote.
Okay, well, that's another...
And,
yeah, that's
and the what, Democratic right. Party is essentially the same. They have about 30% of the vote that embraces identity politics, and it's broken up over the course of 19 other candidates.
Okay, that's an interesting point, although I will say that saying Make America Great Again is a dog whistle about identity politics, whereas the Democrats... are, it's not a dog whistle. They're playing right at middle C. You know, there's no, you know, it's like you... You know, a deaf person could hear what the Democrats are playing, right? But Trump was doing the, you know, we're not a country anymore. We have to be a country. We need borders. We need this. We need that. People should speak English. All of these unite into an identitarian message of a sort, but they are sub Rosa, right? Oh. So where's the sub Rosa aspect of the Warren, Booker, Harris, you know, where is the sub Rosa aspect? Where, what are they saying that will bring all of the identity politics together under one message? You can't. And I will say again on Twitter, very useful, my TV compare Zerlina Maxwell the other day accused people who support Mayor Pete of not understanding intersectionality because he doesn't count. But why doesn't he count? He's gay. Isn't he supposed to count because he's gay? No, because if he's white and male, then he can't possibly count under... So now intersectionality is intersectionality. You know, there's now a subset of intersectionality in which a gay person doesn't fit.
Well, no, a white male experiences less prejudice than a gay man. So the gay man part of him experiences a certain amount of prejudice, but the two... parts white male counteract that prejudice and vault him over the prejudicial threshold.
How I wish I knew what you were saying. But I will say this, you guys. I need to talk to you about Harry Shave, okay? Love Harry Shave. Just did a Harry Shave yesterday. I got some whiskers this morning, I got to admit, because we started early. Here's Harry's story. Harry's founders were tired of paying for razors that were overpriced and overdesigned. They knew a great shave doesn't come from gimmicks like vibrating heads, flex balls, or handles that look like spaceships, tactics that the leading brand has used to raise prices for decades. They fixed that by combining a simple, clean design with quality, durable blades at a fair price. Harry's bought a world-class blade factory in Germany. It's making quality blades for over 95 years. They've received over 20,000 five-star reviews on Trustpilot and Google. Harry's replacement cartridges are just $2 each, half the price of a Gillette Fuse and ProShield. Harry's blades come with a 100% quality guarantee. If you don't love your shave, let them know and they'll give you a full refund. Join the 10 million who have tried Harry's, including me. Claim your trial offer by going to harrys.com/commentary. Get a $13 value trial set that comes with everything you need for a close, comfortable shave. Weighted ergonomic handle, five-blade razor with a lubricating strip and trimmer blade, rich lathering shave gel, and a travel blade cover. Listeners of our show can redeem their trial set at harrys.com/commentary. Make sure you go to harrys.com/commentary to redeem your offer and let them know we sent you to help support the show. So let me give a 2-second monologue here, if that's possible. So many of you may know that, or not know, that I went off Twitter permanently last month. This followed a preposterous controversy in which I made a joke about neutron bombing the NYU journalism school. Neutron bombs, for those of you who are under the age of 50, which was my great mistake here, were a low-yield nuclear weapon that famously would kill people but leave buildings intact. So when this first became a controversy in the early 80s, it was a common joke on all political sides to say, if you say liked a building but you hated its inhabitants, that you should neutron bomb the building. And then you would leave the building standing. And I said they should neutron bomb the NYU Journalism School, and they should put, I don't know, I can't remember who they should put in it.
The college scandal guy. What's his name?
Oh, the Varsity Blues guy.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Okay, so like, so that he should run a side door system. And so I was accused of wanting to kill journalists, mass murder journalists, and, you know, this was just terrible of me, and I'm a monster, I'm a heart. So, okay, so I then wrote a mild apology about this on the commentary website the next day, and I decided about an hour after I had done this that I was going to go off Twitter permanently. Why? After, by the way, I think, you know how it said that, was it 10% of the tweeters produced 80% of the tweets? It really was more like me producing 80% of the tweets. I mean, I think I've in 10 years I wrote 150,000 tweets or something like that. So it was a little compulsive, more than a little compulsive. But I will tell you why I did it. So I did it because there was in no case could I make the case that any single individual tweet that I had ever written was worth defending. Whereas if I write an article, if I write a piece, if I write, and then I get attacked, like then my hackles, I've spent some time, I've given it some thought, people misrepresent you and claim you say things you didn't, and you need to defend, intellectual honesty and seriousness of intellectual discussion requires that you defend yourself and then maybe go on the counterattack. But any individual tweet that I wrote took me a minute. And like if it offends hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people, it wasn't worth the minute that I spent doing it, because that's not, you know, even if I want to be a provocateur and I want to amuse people, and the people that know me know that I didn't want the mass murder of journalists and whatever, it doesn't matter. And then I thought, well, you know, this has now happened enough in my experience and has been unpleasant enough in my experience that I really need to stop doing this. And it was the third or fourth time that I made this pledge to myself. And I went back on the pledge every time. The first time I did it because I wanted to go on and try to establish the story of what happened to the Weekly Standard's closing, because the people at the Weekly Standard were under pressure from their former employer to remain silent in case they could get a buyout package. And so they weren't going to be able to tell the story, but I could tell the story. So I needed to go on the minute that the Standard was folded to set the record straight before anybody could lay out the lies about it. And then I just stayed on, and then other things happened. Okay, so I just want to talk about what this means to me in two ways. One is I feel better. I don't get engaged with pointless, meaningless controversies. I don't get stirred up. My mind is clearer. I'm less. And yet, two things, one of which is Twitter was for me a long time a kind of version of I'm a frustrated stand-up comedian and actor, and so there was something, the performative aspect of it was very helpful in getting that out, that side of my personality. And it was bad because it spoke to my id, and it gave my id access directly to my fingertips and to a computer screen, and I said things and did things and would say and behave in ways that I would never behave with any forethought or, you know, or without channeling that. The second thing I have to say is that I may have done a certain small bit of damage to my career as a public person, because I had 150,000 Twitter followers. I was in front of them all day, helped me get speaking gigs, helped me do a bunch of other things, helped me develop a reputation among people who don't read things on the right and all of that. And now I'm gone from that, and that ecosystem, living in Plato's Cave, if you're in Plato's Cave with a lot of other people in Plato's Cave, that can be useful to you. I don't think that any of that justifies or merits the I don't know, emotional immaturity that is encouraged by the Twitter dopamine rush that Christine talked about. I don't think it's evil. I don't think Twitter is evil. I really don't think Facebook is evil, which most people have now decided that Facebook is evil. Twitter is way worse than Facebook. But I do think that for a certain type of personality, particularly somebody who has a combative streak, and also enjoys some version, as a lot of people do, some kind of gets a certain kind of rush from bullying, which is a real thing, that it's bad. Christine, you've thought a lot about this. You're writing a book about this.
It's designed to hit all those targets. That's exactly what it's designed to do. And it's designed to keep you coming back. I disagree. I actually think Facebook is more evil than Twitter because it's more its tentacles reach further than Twitter's do, as this data suggests. But look, it rewards instantaneous reaction rather than thought, you know, information, not knowledge, the same old discussions people have been having. It can be extremely useful for sharing information. Look, I have to give total kudos to Abe and Noah, because the only reason anyone on Twitter knows I write anything on commentary is that they tweeted out for me, because I don't have a Twitter account. So there's a kind of herd immunity I've gotten as a result of working with people who are good on Twitter. And you tweeted out stuff I'd written when you were still on Twitter. So, but I think that I do see more and more people having the insight that you've had, which is that if it starts to bring out your worst self, it's not something you should be doing. I mean, I think that more people need to have that realization, and then more people who are in the business of idea creation and dissemination need to have a very serious think about whether they're hearing everything they should be hearing and listening to many voices or just in an echo chamber. That effect is unfortunate, and that's just as true on the right as it is on the left, unfortunately.
So just to clarify, when we talk about either Twitter or Facebook being evil, we're not talking about the corporate, the companies necessarily, right?
The,
we're talking the about the
well,
right of
with
of,
Facebook
of,
a little bit,
right.
Facebook, the,
right?
Yeah.
But mostly using it. I mean, I don't think. I mean, I've yet to hear someone make a convincing case to me that it's good. I don't know what if there's a.
Well, the cases that were good have long been blasted, right? Because there was the case that the Tahrir Square, right, was a social media revolution, and that was fantastic, right? Well, first of all, Tahrir Square, I don't know what you want to say about it now, wasn't such a great thing.
Right.
And, of course, the other thing about social, then, you know, stuff with the Purple Revolution in Iran and various other, that where all the positive, forward-thinking, futuristic, this is a new way to organize and do things stuff seem to have come a croppers, to the extent that people were celebrating the fact that Sri Lanka shut off social media in the wake of the horrific Easter bombings in order to prevent copycats from conveying messages to each other over social media.
That was the bookend moment for hashtag activism, I think. That's important.
Yeah, exactly. And people were like, well, that makes perfect sense. They got to do what they can to make sure that ISIS isn't communicating, isn't communicating in this way. I want to tell one last story, if I can, that I heard yesterday. So I had lunch with a friend of mine who is a columnist, and I hadn't seen her in a while. And we were talking about Twitter and stuff like that. And she said, you know, it drives people crazy. And I said, I know. And she said, well, you know, there was this thing that happened with you. And I said, what are you talking about? And she said, well, you know, I wrote this column about Jeff Flake. And you tweeted out and said it was the dumbest thing you'd ever read. And you didn't do it. You didn't do it once. You did it twice. And I was talking to a third mutual friend of ours. And, I said to him, hey, you know, John was just at my house for dinner 2 weeks ago. Like, what is he doing? And I said, and this is true, I have absolutely no memory of this. I have no memory of having done this. This was like two years ago. I have no memory. I can't believe I did that. And she said, well, Twitter was making you crazy. And she was right. Like, I didn't even remember the piece that she was talking about, let alone that I had reacted that way, let alone that I had gone public with it when I consider her a friend, not a close friend, obviously, since I hadn't seen her in, you know, a year and a half. And I felt just absolutely terrible. But there is this kind of demonic quality. And by demonic, I don't mean that I was possessed by a demon. I mean demonic in the sort of Greek set. Like, it is possible for a bad self part of you to emerge in social media. The reason I say Facebook isn't as evil is that I just think the social costs of being ugly on Facebook are much worse. You were rewarded for being ugly to some extent on Twitter. I don't know that you were rewarded that much for being ugly on Facebook. Facebook corporately may be much worse. I don't know. Noah's grimacing.
Yeah, I just find Facebook unusable, generally. I just couldn't navigate it after a certain point. It was all advertisements and other, you know, unfounded nonsense that was being, you know, pushed out by people who want to live in their own world of, you know, fake news, as it were. So, you know, I just found it utterly worthless. At least there's some social pressure on you on Twitter if you are to advance nonsensical propagandistic garbage that isn't founded by anything. Then people will, you know, come on top of you and correct you. And I don't see that on Facebook.
But no one's listening to on Facebook. I mean, no one goes to Facebook to get...
No, I don't think it's a threat to democracy. Yeah. I'm not going to hold congressional hearings over this thing like some of our colleagues are in the Congress, but I just think it's just really worthless.
Okay, I will finish with this thought, which is that the best thing that Joe Biden could do is ignore Twitter. No, I'm think
yes,
about it.
Yes,
yeah.
The best thing that he could do is say, I am above this medium. I am not engaging with people on this medium. It's Trump's medium. It's the vulgar medium. It's like people who just want to, you know, mouth off instead of do real things. And I am not playing.
He's already demonstrated he's not going to do this. And I'll also predict that the sotto voce, if you support one of these two non-identitarian candidates, then you're probably a little bit racist yourself. Line that's being bandied about yesterday is going to get a lot more explicit, and you cannot afford to ignore that if you're in the Democratic primary.
Yeah, but how? But here's my question: in 280 characters, mm-hmm. how on earth do you combat it?
In a video, up on Twitter, and that's it.
But it's an unanswer. It's a charge that is by definition unanswerable.
Yeah,
there's no way to disprove it. There's no way to attack it.
No, the idea is to impose on Democratic voters a moral quandary.
Right. So I'm saying that Biden's whole hope is that he is a figure that sits above this and talks to everybody and doesn't seek to, you know, filter down to 40 different identity politics groups.
Yeah, but Noah's right. He's not. He's micromanaging his left flank. Right. You know.
Well, it's the
crazy
classic,
way to spend a campaign.
But it's the classic Miller Lite problem of presidential candidacies then, which is Biden's going to be everything you always wanted in a beer, but less, right? I'll give you everything you want, mm-hmm. but I'm not going to give it to you, you know, in as hearty and you know, satisfying a way as you could get from, you know, a more incendiary, you know, from Bernie, right? I'll be like Bernie, only less. Is that a successful message? I don't know. But Twitter, the more time that candidates... This, I think, is the ultimate takeaway from the Pew survey. The more time that people take trying in who want to do something that changes the country take and descending into Twitter and trying to manage, become a master of it, the more dangerous it is to their ambitions to speak to everybody.
Well, look at AOC, right? She was a master of social media, and what has she sort of done with it? I mean, she's
become famous, right?
Yeah,
she's become that world. She's become the most famous person in Congress, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, but
what's she going to do with it?
Well, yeah, but also her support is suffering. I mean,
yeah.
I mean, she's famous without sort of representing anyone,
right?
She won 15,000 votes in New York City, guys.
Well, no, right? No, that was in a primary. Yeah, well, we'll see. She's, you know, her support is suffering. When she runs again, it'll be like one of these. She'll be running against somebody, and they won't even be able to. First of all, she's a Democrat in a Democratic district. Unless someone primaries her, she's got that seat forever. So,
by the way, she's the sort of, she is the square root of the Pew polls idea of high Twitter
that's
user.
Right, that's right. That's right. Educated, female, young, educated, female, very woke.
Right.
Yep.
Yeah. So no wonder it's her media.
Right.
And Trump's being, because as you know, he's very well educated.
That's right.
He's very educated. You know, he went to Wharton. I don't know if you know that.
He also knows the best words.
And he has a higher income. And he has a higher income than most people.
Right.
Anyway, with that, we will bring this to a close. For Christine, Noah, and Abe, I'm John Podhoretz. Keep the candle burning.